Less controversial stuff. Like you're not a theist if you don't. Anyway. Yeah, no, I'm on right now. Okay, so atemporality. Now I said that this is a third of the 4 points. Atemporality in two senses, but of course here I just mean two things you can mean by it. In fact, all right. So let's do this again. Eternity above the line, since I erased the whole board, and time below the line. Notice that everything follows this Kantian flow. All these problems show up. Not that there was never a form of these things before Kant, just like there was agnosticism before Kant. It's just that this is such a dominant grid in our minds that everything else is interpreted by it. Now, if you do talk about eternity and God in a timeless eternity, that still begs the question. You could choose to say that God exists in a timeless eternity, or that he exists at a point in time, or that he exists at all times. But if we suppose that God is his own eternity, then why should we regard this timeless state as something that transcends God at all? In other words, something into which God must fit. So even when we say God is in eternity, our God is in the heavens, Psalm 115:3. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that eternity is here, God is a smaller circle inside that place? Well, obviously, I hope, that's not what the classical thinkers meant. To repeat, this is an entailment of divine infinity, that he is illimitable by time, or that he is atemporal. So the very meaning of the word atemporal, you could just... I don't think all-spatial is a word, but you don't need to make it a word because you have that he is spirit. In fact, even, like I said, the doctrine of his immensity, that's not helpful today because we are picture thinkers. And so all this means, atemporal, is he is illimitable by time. He is not able to be limited by time. So that he is atemporal in his essence does not imply that the object of his experience is therefore atemporal. Again, above the line, essence of God, below the line, manifestation of God. Or maybe I should put expression, but I don't want to. I'll put manifestation of God. So, which that still is not, we still have to beg some questions there so people don't get the wrong idea. I'm not under the impression that that's going to solve everybody's problem. I understand that. So let's just keep digging here. These are two totally different things. His essence, his manifestation. Something other than God may be an object of his experience without it either being a part of him, or that which in his essence experiences a part of the creation. That would be either pantheism or panentheism. So in other words, when we say the manifestation of God, we mean at least that it's not part of the essence of God. In other words, the burning bush, for example. Where is the voice coming from? Well, stop right there. You're already assuming that voice is part of the essence of God. This is just like Jonah and the whale or the virgin birth. If you have no problem with God creating the universe, you shouldn't have any problem with him making a, people, there was a whale, a kind of whale, a species of whale that was that had a stomach this big and you could see in the fossil and this, you don't need to do that, whether there was or not. Maybe God made a Jonah eating whale one time. You say, well, that's convenient. Well, leave that aside for a second. If you have no problem with God creating everything out of nothing, why in the world, at least philosophically, I understand picture thinking wise and existentially, you might have a problem with things like a virgin birth, but philosophically, why do you have a problem with it? One's a subsection of the other, and a very puny one at that. So, by manifestation of God, whether it's the voice coming from the burning bush, or him covenanting with Abraham and so on, we're not talking about the essence of God. That would be pantheism, or at least a partial pantheism. So, our two senses of atemporality are of the one true God on the one hand, and a straw man on the other. True atemporality would relate the temporal more perfectly than the critics construct of their God. For the same reason that a truly transcendent being would also be the most immanent being. A truly transcendent being would pervade. Yeah, we talked about that, even down to the coffee cup. Remember we talked about that as 2 weeks, 2-3 weeks ago, whatever it was. But the same thing's going to be happening here. If God is truly God and the creation is truly creation, then just for the same reason that a truly transcendent being has to be the most immanent being, not just immanent, the most immanent being. If you're not everywhere present, if anything eludes you, escapes you, if any point knows another point more than you do, well, they're not totally transcendent. In this case, omniscient and atemporal. So, true atemporality would relate to the temporal in the same way. Hyper-temporal. If you want a God who relates to time, you must have a timeless God. He will relate to time better than you do. He will be nearer to you than you are if he's transcendent to you. You are less near to your friend precisely because you're not God. You are less able to read his thoughts, to help him in his heart, precisely because you're not God. If you want to be more near, you have to be more transcendent. If you want to help the small, you have to be bigger. Common sense, when you think about it, nobody thinks about it. We split these things because Kant told us to. As Helm summarized it, quote, God's eternal existence has no temporal relations whatever to any particular thing which he creates. Follow this. God's eternal existence, above the line, has no temporal relations whatever to any particular thing which he creates. This does not mean that there are no relations at all between the eternal God and his creation, only no temporal relations. In other words, what Helm is saying is just that the nature of this relationship, its root, is not temporal. The temporal thing to which God relates remains temporal. Yet the essential nature of the relationship of the timeless to time is not temporal. The timeless is essential. The temporal is not. The timeless came first and makes the temporal what it is at every point. The timeless is creative. The temporal is the created. The superior defines the relationship between superior and inferior, between cause and effect, between infinite and finite. This is just monotheism walking around without apology. If you want eternity to relate to time, you'd better ask eternity what he thinks about it. If you want eternity to relate to time, eternity had better have created time. If you want God to be your friend, you better hope he's really big. Because you've got some big problems down here. This is just monotheism applied to everything. A timelessness that is unable to manifest in time is a notion particular to the Neoplatonists. Now, that's what the critics will say. And it's true. A timelessness that is unable to manifest in time is a notion particular to that philosophical school, the Neoplatonists, dealing with the one. So there's this inability, particularly Gnosticism, and of course that's the assumption, from this Neoplatonic, this perfection of this one, comes this unable. You see it in Aristotle as well, but it really doesn't touch the Christian community except in this form. So in Gnosticism, well, Gnosticism's over here. This is a description of the Gnostic inference from Neoplatonism. This is so pure, this is so transcendent, that he couldn't possibly say this to divide. And so you can reach back into examples like this and say, you see, here is what happens when you make God too transcendent. Now, whether or not early Christians were corrupted by this teaching is a burden that the critic must prove. We've already seen how dubious this case is, that this corruption was universal to the patristic era. At any rate, it simply begs the question to equate the classical Christian to the classical pagan, and then move on from there to restrict any definition of timelessness to a fusion together of the divine essence and the divine manifestation. The two are not the same in any being. In other words, your essence and your manifestation are not the same. This coffee cup's essence and its manifestation is not the same. The light from the sun and the sun is the light source. These are not the same things in any being. Why should we assume that they're the same in God? The voice from the burning bush. Therefore, we conclude with full logical and scriptural warrant that the ontological experience of God... Now, here's the remaining difficulty. Okay, I buy this. Then in what sense does God say now and then and no? Here it is.
Above this line, there is an ontological experience. So you're saying, okay,
here's God ontologically, here's him experientially. Well, then how does he ontologically as a person experience? Okay, we haven't got to that yet. You may be assuming that the only way you can experience something is to experience it as we do. Remember what happened to personhood. If differentiated, therefore personal. If stumbles and falls and hurts his knee a lot, therefore personal. Well, stop! That's not the Christian worldview talking anymore. So, the ontological experience of God, well, it's no, there's no succession of moments. Well, how many other beings do you know that don't experience succession of moments that have bad experiences? Let me cut that sentence in half. How many other beings do you know that don't have succession of moments? Okay, so what's your standard? So that the burden of proof is on the critic at that point. That's just problem number one. So the ontological experiencing of God, how did I phrase the opposite of that? The manifest experience of God. Does God manifest... I'll write before I talk. Does the manifestation of God experience, and does he, I'll go a step further, does he experience as we do? Yes, in Christ. But we'll get to that. But does his manifestations experience? Yes, the voice was related to the fire. The voice came out of the fire and related to Moses' eardrums. But notice that that's actually less personal now than the ontological experiencing of God. The person of God experienced better and more personally than the voice, the audible sound waves, related to the eardrum. Okay, so the shoe's on the other foot here, but I just say that in passing. You have to draw a distinction between this ontological experience of God, God in himself, that's timeless, and the manifest experience of God, which is truly of time, in time, for the sake of time, and so on. The burden of proof is squarely on anyone who maintains that divine ontological timelessness is incompatible with the ability for God to know from this eternity each individual finite point. Remember, that's the subjective. Okay, as an other. So in other words, here's a knower knowing. Here's a knower. In other words, this is an event called a knower knowing, in this case, what time it is. Okay, four different. I'm going to use an elaborate example in just a little bit to make the point of come home. But the burden of proof is on somebody who wants to say that from eternity, he cannot know these perfectly as objects in a frozen, well, frozen, what are we talking about? Cold? There's no chill factor in heaven. Okay? So again, you're loading in picture thinking at that point. Burden of proof is on anybody to say that he cannot know these objects, which again, remember, are also subjects. They're subjective vantage points. But to God, they're also objects. In other words, that is 601. As a referent, and two people that are having that argument, all three of those now, are objects to God, and he knows them perfectly. The burden of proof is on anybody who wants to show that he can't do that and know it as a subject. It would seem from the position of divine immensity, or omnipresent, God's a spirit, that God could know infinitely more of each subjective point as an object. So if you're mistaken that it's 601, God knows that you're mistaken a lot more than the guy who points out that you're mistaken. God actually knows more about your error than somebody else who caught it down here. More than the finite mind from within that same point. On what ground? From within the nature of eternity, remember, to make this argument, you have to say that eternity, eternal knowing, is the kind of thing that can't, remember, atheology and their problems. You have to have knowledge of eternal knowing to make this case. From within the nature of eternity, on what ground would you say that eternally grounded objective knowledge must be logically inconsistent with this eternal knower knowing more than the temporally constrained subjective knower? You can't do it. Now notice that there's never an answer to this question. They never get that deep. Instead, there's an equivocation that runs through the whole debate. The objective eternal act of knowing knowing the subjective temporal object is redefined, whether it's by sleight of hand or mere incompetence. What they're saying in the objection, God can't know if he can't know that it's 601 now, meaning he can't experience 601-ness the same way I do. What? Stop. Card trick. You just loaded a bunch of stuff that are not knowing into the definition of it's 601. So, the objective eternal act that knowledge is. Put below that line in quotes, it's 601. I won't even put now, because you know, it's that pretty much implied, that indexical. The objective eternal act of knowing the subjective temporal object is redefined, whether by sleight of hand or incompetence, as the, here's a new definition, as the ability of an eternal consciousness to know as the finite consciousness knows, which comes to mean something less specific than knowing at all. In fact, we're asking the question, or we're asking omniscience, we're asking an omniscient being to begin to pull off the feats of forgetting, or haziness, or trying desperately to peek around a corner with us, which the last time I checked is no longer knowledge at all, but the lack thereof. And if we remember our tips on logical equivalence, this is no different than the demand that omnipotence make a rock too heavy for itself to lift. You're demanding that omniscience knows less, and calling that knowledge. Every other mistake in here is committing that error. Now, there's a most manifest way that divine atemporality coheres. I mentioned this in passing before, but let me just mention it. There's a clear way, the clearest way, that divine atemporality coheres with and comes in to divine immanence in time. And that is the incarnation of Christ. This unity is specifically forced on us by a huge, this is a Latin word, or two Latin words. Don't be afraid. Communicatio. Idiomatum. It was a Latin phrase that the old theologians came up with to explain, another big word, the hypostatic union. In other words, the doctrine of the two natures of Christ. What it means is the communication of the attributes. So the communicatio idiomatum was a way in which you could understand, you know what, I'm going to put those in the line too. So let me do this. Erase this, and I'm going to graphically demonstrate the incarnation, the doctrine of the two natures. Above the line, divine. Below the line, human. These two natures are united. They're not two persons, not two beings, two natures. Perfectly united in one perfect person. Well, how does that work? Is it a human person or a divine person? Well, unless you say it's a divine person, you have something again, Latin, not only less than Christianity, you have less than theism again. Because now God is joining himself to the created and is caused by it. That won't work. So, all classical theologians would say there is one divine person who has two natures. Now, the doctrine of the communicatio idiomatum was meant to say that whatever one of the natures has, the whole person has. The communication of the attributes to the person. Which does not mean that there are two persons. Now, I'm not going to unpack that. That's Christology. But I have done a class on that if you want to refer to that. But where does the Bible say that we see God most clearly? And the answer is in Jesus Christ. There's no comparing the God of Scripture and the God of the philosophers unless we're permitted to stack up our doctrine of Christ to the blind lashings of the philosopher. So this Latin phrase, coined by the early church fathers, refers to this unity of the two natures of Christ in the one divine person, God the Son. Notice how it solves all the philosophical problems. Transcendence and immanence and so on. I say notice, but that takes a whole 13 weeks in and of itself to show all the way, just like the Trinity. So this doctrine of the two natures winds up solving a lot of, because notice in creation you have this disunity. And you have, and so the need is the reconciliation, the unity of the transcendent and the immanent, of the eternal and the temporal. So, consideration of the unity of these attributes concerns this disunity of man as he is. So, I'm not going to get into all these other things that I have here because it's just examples of the way that this solves the problem. So let's just use this in our discussion of eternity versus time. Where do I start that? Let's just go down here. So let's apply this unity of these philosophical problems in the person of Christ to our more specific divide between eternity and time. So can God, beyond time, so if I'm saying God is timeless, can he enter into time if we assume that the human nature in time has communicated all of his attributes to the divine person that is timeless? Again, the communication... Okay, sorry. One more thing this doesn't mean. This will solve the problem right away. I didn't even think about this. I did in the Christology class, but I'm doing this on the fly, so just I didn't have time to think about it. Yeah. So, by the way, the communication of the human attributes to the divine person does not mean the communication of the human attributes to the divine attributes. The divine attributes do not become human attributes. The divine attributes do not become less because the incarnation has happened. So those are debates that have happened in the history of the church. But this doctrine is particularly saying that the person has united to. But that it does not say that the divine is intermixed with the human. That's one of the early heresies, monophysitism, one nature. It becomes one nature. That's not what this doctrine is saying. So, can God, beyond time, enter into time if we assume that the human nature in time has communicated, joined, unified his attributes to the divine person that is timeless? Well, in the Orthodox doctrine of Christ, we are obliged to say that the atemporal and the temporal both belong to the one God at the same time and in the same relation. Wouldn't that be the irresistible conclusion? The same time, the same relationship. That's the law of logic, right? Well, did you notice that word time? In that formulation of the law of non-contradiction, it says at the same time, such that for any event in time, a coherent thing must fulfill two conditions of non-contradiction. A must be non-A at the same time and in the same relation. So I can see how that would trip people up. But here's the problem with that. What if the thing we're talking about is not in time at all? Which in this case, it's timelessness that we're talking about. In that case, the clause at the same time is only a matter of speaking. This is not the only case that that's the case. Think about mathematics. For example, 3 plus 3 cannot be both 6 and 7 at the same time and in the same relation. Nobody would disagree with that. But notice that this is the case not because this sum 6 really could be 7 if only at a different time. You see that? So the sum is not really time sensitive at all. It's a matter of speaking. 3 plus 3 cannot be both 6 and 7 at any time, precisely because 6-ness is atemporal. So in other words, in the law of logic, at the same time and in the same relationship, the word time is used metaphorically. You're not actually saying that logical relations are dependent upon time. Okay? It's a metaphorical way of saying the law. So with that clue firmly grasped, when we return to the communicatio idiomatum, the reason that the timeless God can be in time with respect to his human nature is at least owing to the nature of the divine nature. If the divine nature is already omnipresent with respect to spatial presence, then this divine nature does not become less than the same in the incarnation. He unites temporal experience to himself in his Son, not by becoming less than timeless in his divine nature, but by becoming other than timeless in his human nature. Should anybody complain that this whole doctrine of the hypostatic union is incoherent? They'll have plenty of company among modern liberal theologians, and they'll also have the same burden of proof that those modern liberals have never once satisfied. They'll also share the same sentiments as David Hume, who in his dialogues insisted that the notion of God's eternal attributes is utterly at war with his personal attributes. Why can't two natures, divine and human, subsist in one eternal person? That rationale, as you look back to 2 weeks ago with the Trinity, that rationale is going to fall for the very same reason as we saw with objections to the Trinity. In them, there is a misconstruing of that which is beyond the bounds of mystery and that which is incoherent. But two such natures in one person, two whats, one who. Remember the Trinity? One what, three whos. In this you have one who, two whats. Violates no law of logic, no matter what other experiences or sensibilities it might offend. It does not violate any law of logic. So again, it's just one of those cases where the burden of proof is on the person who wants to say that these two natures cannot be united in one person, because one and two, well, stop there. That's the fallacy of equivocation. It's one who and two whats. Last point, a more direct response to this whole challenge against divine timelessness. The most certain proof that God is beyond time is to begin with the premise that's found in 1 Corinthians 8:6. You could also find it in John 1:3 and Colossians 1:16. But here I'm just going to quote 1 Corinthians 8:6. And I'm going to drop a piece of chalk. And it's this: there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things. Let's erase this now. And the way John 1:3 and Colossians 1:16 say it are somewhat different, but it's the same thing. God created all things. So, let's set up a syllogism, which I will fill out in just a second, but let me give it to you in plain English first. From this premise, time is either one of these things or else not. If time is not one of the things in the set of all things, then time does not exist. But if time does exist, then time must belong to the class all things. Now, if God created all things, and if time is one thing in the set of all things, then it follows by resistless logic that God created time. And that was easy. But that's pretty clear. So let's arrange this as a syllogism. Premise one. All things, I'm going to underline those words. All things, so in the set of things, this is all of its members. By the way, if you want to be more technical, again, more indexicals. This is the way John 1:3 says it. Without him, nothing has been made that has been made. Okay, so if you want to do that, fine. All created things. But I'm assuming that you know what I mean. So I'll put that in for whoever does it. All created things are created by God. So, but I'll just say all things are created by God. Second premise. Time is one thing. Now, if time and the nature of it and its relationship to eternity is going to be your first premise, you had better not go with time does not exist. I'm just going out on the limb there and saying that the critics here don't want to deny this second premise. Time is one thing. I don't think they want to disagree with that, because their whole argument would fall the other way. Therefore, conclusion, time was created by God. That is a syllogism so uncontroversial and so irrefutable and so undesirable to refute that I don't even know what to say, except to put it on the board. But several objections could be imagined. One is to begin with the assumption that time is an uncreated thing. And that's what you get in, for example, Craig and other people. Perhaps the universe is eternally old, as the ancient Greeks believed, or as the modern materialist does. In this case, premise one would be unsound. However, the disadvantage of that, in addition to all the other problems that we've already talked about, is that it would directly contradict Scripture. Now, you say, no, Scripture never uses the sentence, God created time, period. Again, I would refer you back to our study on the Trinity and other things. If the same thing is said in other ways, then and it's true that premise two is a deduction from premise one. So you could say, time is not the sort of thing that God created. Or, time is an uncreated thing in God. Now, that's why, by the way, if you disagree with atemporality, you also have to attack divine simplicity. You see why? Because if time is not one of these things, but it is a thing, then it is a part of God. And either that means, as it tried to mean for Stump and Kretzmann, that time is successive. It's non-successive. It's so you have this other kind of duration. Or in William Lane Craig, you can argue for this kind of succession in God. And it's fine. It's not that kind of a thing. If you do that, if you go with option two, you have to say that time has parts. And therefore, God has parts. God has a division. And so, the same people typically that debate this issue also reject the idea of divine simplicity. Which, as we talked about before, then you have to start attacking the idea of divine self-sufficiency, and some do. And the whole Christian faith unravels in due time. And so does rationality, as we've covered in a previous week. But any challenge to the second premise would instantly collapse the critic's case, for if time is not a thing in any sense, then it is not a thing that could be known. Beyond that fairly uncontroversial point, time must also be one thing, not everything. And this one thing under investigation must be one member in its class, similar to the difference between man and that man. So in other words, the critic believes that time exists, time, capital T, and that this time, namely 8:47 a.m. on October 25th, 2011, this time is the thing that the God of Scripture must know and therefore must be within. Now that leaves us to combine the first and second premise and ask the critic if he accepts. Is this time a created thing? In other words, is it caused as an effect, such that it will issue forth as a cause into a subsequent effect? Again, not many people would disagree with that. Well, then it would seem that each unit of time that the critic is so zealous to protect from that cold, undifferentiated colossus God of classical theism is a thing with a nature. In other words, each unit of time is a finite object to be known as an object. And so their view collapses from the other end. In other words, their idea of eternal knowing as not of an object collapses. So if time, these units of time, are things with a nature, then their view of omniscience, or scientia in general, knowledge, collapses. Now, the moment you object to that and say, no, if God knows it completely, then this all knowledge has to include that unit of knowledge which is subjective, or knowing it as we know it. Again, notice that this is no longer knowledge per se that we're speaking of. It is either a non-intellectual way of experiencing, such as getting up to get a better view. If I know more because I got up to get a better view, it's not because any part of my getting up or the spatial dimensions is part of that knowing. Knowing is an intellectual act, it is an objective act, and as we saw, it's an eternal act. Or they're talking about a lack of knowledge altogether. In other words, know it as I know it. What do you mean? Like, not in relation to the last time it was 6:01 and somebody had fried chicken? Well, I never thought about that. Yeah, and there's a infinite amount of other things just like it. God knows that. You're talking about less knowledge, not more knowledge. Let me draw this out with a simple example. Basketball. If God is omniscient, I'll draw four things on you. And he must know these four things. Notice that they're all things. That's the crucial thing I want to drive at. So I want to use another example that's tangible, going on in the world right now. I guess it's World Series time. I probably should have used something like that, but whatever. You get the idea. These four things. I guess I did A, B, C, and D, but whatever. If God is omniscient, then he must know that. Now, I'm going to put this word in caps. He knows that. That's going to be very, all three of these are a thing with a nature. He knows that Kobe Bryant released the jump shot before the buzzer sounded. Okay? It's going to be a dispute here. Nasa got the shot off. Before the buzzer sounded. Now imagine this is right on the buzzer. Okay? Milliseconds. B, he must know that the referee called the shot off. So notice there's a warring perspective, a finite subjective perspective. That the referee called off the shot. Ref called off the shot. Three, that, again, now we're going to get into the No, they're all subjective. Only the first one is really the objective part. But again, they're all objects. See that it was 10:05 in Los Angeles and 7:05 in Boston. So,
and by the way, this isn't going to change anything dramatically. But I just want to add more static in here to show you there's a lot of perspectives, a lot of people watching on TV in Boston and in LA.
The Celtics and Lakers, by the way. And fourthly, that from the referee's perspective, as well as the perspective of Celtic fans watching back home in Boston, the last molecules of the ball rolled off the last molecules of Kobe's fingertips at 10:05.00, although in fact, this occurred at 10:04.56. So, how do I demonstrate that? I will put the two perspectives. One is going to be 10:05.00, some shot clocks and whatever have it this specifically. 10:04.5, whatever, you get that idea, 5:06. Only the Lord knew, and all the fans in the Staples Center watching home in Los Angeles knew it with equal omniscience. So, but that's not true. But only the Lord knew it in fact. Now observe that what is signified by that word that, four times in this proposition, he knew that this, he knew that that, he knew that that, he knew that that. To the newcomer to philosophy, this might look like differences between objective and subjective points. And they are. Sorry, let me put this on here too. Just a reminder. Not all objective things are subjective. But all subjective things are also object. If it's a thing, it's a thing with a nature. It is the case. That's what's being lost in the shuffle here. Epistemology has gone subjective in the modern era, starting especially with Locke, but especially hyperjet with Kant. Side note, sorry. So, what is signified by the word that, four times here, represents four objective states of affairs that God knows. To the newcomer to philosophy, perhaps these four things don't really strike us as things. Or perhaps if they do, they remain diverse things with nothing to unify them except our own finite minds. But since we're speaking among those who are at least philosophical theists, let's all at least agree that if God is omniscient, then his knowledge of these four states of affairs is a perfect knowledge of them as objects. To know everything about them is precisely to know them as things. The real distraction operating on the student of philosophy is that in a matter of speaking, what distracts us, I think, is that in a matter of speaking, 1 through 3 strike us as facts about objective events. While, in other words, shot off, ref called it that way, we're not really talking about his perspective yet. We're just what his perspective caused, namely him calling off the shot, the time being different in those two places. And now, four strikes us through the magic of the word perspective as subjective impressions, whether they conform to the facts or not. So we easily forget that while not everything objective is a subjective thing, every subjective thing is also an objective thing. In other words, there are personal things and there are impersonal things, but there are never personal non-things. So to say the same obvious thing another way, all things are things, objects. Personal, impersonal, doesn't matter. All things, if they're things, are things. They're objects. Some of those things are personal or perspectival or subjective. So do you now see the problem in our thinking about what omniscience ought to be able to not know and call that knowledge? The varying perspectives of the referee, the players, the Celtic fans, the Laker fans are, in addition to being subjective, they are also, first and foremost, objective. Things with natures. Everything, after all, is a thing. Hence its name, everything. Which is why everything is objective in this primary sense. Now let's tile this together. If we demand that omniscience know, in quotes, the buzzer-beating jump shot completely, in other words, the way that the various fans, players, and referees knew, in quotation marks, it, then it is no longer any of the its in the object that we want God to know. Let me say that again. If we want God to know these various things in the same way that these various players, referees, subjective points knew it, then it is no longer any of the its in the object that we want God to know. Notice that on any of their perspectives, none of them have exhaustive relational knowledge of any of the things. So you're defining omniscience as not even science. You see that? This is what's happening in these highly overpaid philosophers. We're no longer talking about the same thing in whole or in parts. It would seem as if the referee, in spite of not being omniscient, at least had an infinitely better attention span than the contemporary philosopher. Another argument could be easily imagined. Two more, this is my last page. Just Anselm's argument and the cosmological argument. Apply the same logic to this situation. Let's utilize the ontological argument of Anselm, apply it to this issue. He actually utilized this great-making property, eternality, timelessness, to argue for God's existence as such. In other words, in the middle of saying that this being, than which none greater can be conceived, well, one of the things he conceived of is timelessness. Now, if we're agreed on the validity of Anselm's logic, and I'm only appealing to those people at this point, then we're also forced to agree with the existence of a timeless God. The reason is simply that the greatest conceivable being must be infinite, not limited. Now, whatever is infinite is immutable, and the immutable is not subject to time. Any being that is inside of time, moved by time, restricted by time, is not infinite by definition and therefore not the first cause. But since a greater being can be conceived than one who is not the first cause of all other things and limited by other things, it follows that the greatest conceivable being must be eternal or must transcend time. That really follows from this syllogism anyway, but I'm just using Anselm's language. Last, I leave the most ironic demonstration in this controversy for last. We said it on our break and I wasn't on, so let me say it when we're on. One of the chief proponents of a God inside of time is William Lane Craig. Interesting, since it is he who has most effectively articulated the Kalam cosmological argument in our day. This argument, we'll remember, shows how the infinite series of past events cannot be traversed. So how exactly does Craig hold to both this form of the cosmological argument and a God in whom is an infinite succession of events? His solution is to suppose this pre-creation time as infinite time, which is undifferentiated and therefore not a strict succession of moments or events. My response, what becomes of the whole motive and rationale for the objection to timelessness? The motive is to resurrect the living God, remember from that week a couple weeks ago, the motive for process theology and open theism. The motive is to resurrect the living God from the Platonic cast of the classical theologians. A God without succession of events, without movement within his own mind, is apparently lifeless. Now, Craig's version allows for mental events. His view of epistemic chains, here's an answer to your question, what does he do? He allows mental events being a succession. Problem is, it just applies the same logic to mental events. And we see that most clearly. We know this is the way he treats it, because in his work on epistemic chains of events in Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview, and his colleague J.P. Moreland clearly agrees with him, because Moreland used another version of C.S. Lewis's argument in Miracles for this epistemic proof of the existence of God. In other words, this first cause of ground for knowing against naturalism. So we know that Craig and Moreland think like that in terms of this succession. So Craig's version allows for these mental events, but you have to ask yourself, how does that escape the cosmological logic that you can't have that infinite regress of events? They're just mental events. So to have personhood, apparently, one must be able to deliberate and communicate and remember and act outside of oneself. And those are my earlier. I knew those were my last page. But again, I would just, that is the motivation. The motivation is that same thing that we talked about 2 weeks ago, to uncover the personal living God from, and here's the assumption, a God who starts up here. Even if we accept some of these attributes, if you start your definition of up there, or of God up there, he's less like us, and in one sense, of course, that's true, but the implication is that the transcendent attributes and the immanent attributes are by definition at war with each other, and that's the burden of proof. The new theist must show how that's the case, and they cannot do so logically by the nature of the case. And we talked about that. To be utterly transcendent, you have to be utterly intimate, imminent, more personal than persons who are differentiated, who die. Dying is really, you're not as personal afterwards. You can do less. It's a strain on the old black book. You do less. Point made. Questions?